A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Slaughter Podcast will be discussing topics that some listeners may find disturbing.
If you're still listening and not watching Making a Murderer Part 2, then you're a true fan. Not because we don't like it, just because, like, you could be doing other things. But you're here, so thanks. So,
I've literally just put down the pen from researching this story. I'm sitting here in some questionable fake tan. I turned up and Emma opened the door. This is Lucy, by the way. And Emma was like, oh, you are very tanned. I was like, I've still got to wash off.
I was like, in my head rehearsing, how am I going to bring up the fact that it's really bad?
Well, at least you know that I'm not after your boyfriend if I've turned up looking like this.
It's like really like golden. Like,
it's skinny tan. We are not endorsed. But it, like, once I wash it off, you can barely notice it.
Is it all over?
Yeah, and I was like, why bother? Because unless Luke's bothered or I'm bothered, I should have just done hands and face. Because that's all anyone's seeing for the next
winter.
6 months.
Yeah, like the other day, I only shaved my ankles to go to my friend's birthday party. Mm. Done.
It's because my makeup's the wrong colour. Like, I've gone, like, paper pale now. So anyway.
There you go.
Although pale is cool if you're choosing that kind of life. So this is the death of Francis Saville Kent. I think a lot of people either like called him Saville or Saville, but I think because of like links to Jimmy Saville, I'm just going to go with Francis.
Sure.
I'd just rather.
That's quite sad. No one. There's lots of people called Saville though.
Yeah.
It's quite a common name. You're going to have to.
And also I don't know whether it's Saville or Saville, but I can say Francis.
Francis Saville.
So the setting of the story is, so it's an old one, 1856, the village of Road in Wiltshire, and it's an elegant Georgian house, which is my optimum, like, sort of beautiful house era. And it was a prosperous family who had, like, a big house, servants, living, like, a nice life. So the parents were Samuel Saville Kent, so Samuel Kent, and then Mary Ann Kent. So Mary Ann Kent was sometimes described as a bit of a mad woman.
just casually. Well, that's not a very nice thing to describe your friends as.
Well, I've got a lot of reasons why I don't think she's mad. So
is she just one of those women that spoke in public?
Well, possibly.
Like that one I did before, it's like, oh, she told her husband off in front of other people. She was insane. She should have been murdered.
Yeah, effectively. So, like the evidence for her sort of being, I'm going to use like air quotes, mad, is because like people in the family passed down that, oh yeah, Mary Ann was a bit mad. She had 4 children who died in a row quite young. And they use this as evidence of a weak disposition, which I think is bullshit.
Evidence of postnatal depression.
Well, that's
or what, just grief.
Yeah, well, that's what it sort of suggested online and in the books that I read. But she maintained a marriage. She cared for her children. And there are sort of some reasons that it's that she could have been sort of a little bit funny. So some of this madness could be down to the fact that her husband was openly cheating a lot.
That would do it.
she's...
That still happens now. That's the classic crazy ex-girlfriend gaslighting, isn't it? Like, oh, I cheated on her, but she's crazy. She just went crazy. Yeah. She couldn't handle it when I was a dick for the entire relationship.
Yeah, exactly. And also, both Marianne and Samuel likely had syphilis, which is sort of a madness disorder, isn't it? It's a sexually transmitted disease, but it's said to sort of make you go a bit mad because I think it attacks parts of the brain. So that could be linked to it. And apparently she had like minor delusions and things, but that would sort of solve it. And she was consistently pregnant. She's having all these kids.
So a bit mad was genuinely the kind thing to say about her then.
I think she was doing pretty well.
Because everything is going off.
She's isolated at home with nothing to do. Her husband's off either shagging or working. And she's rich enough to have servants that she can't actually do any housework either. And also it was the kind of time where you wouldn't really have a close relationship with your children. It was seen that like the children would be seen and not heard, that you'd just be sort of their disciplinarian and their teacher, and then the governess would have a closer relationship with the kids. So she didn't even have the kids to talk to. I know that they used to go to the extent, because I used to go around museums. I think my parents used to drag me around sort of these stately homes, and they wouldn't have heating in the part of the house where the kids were.
Keep them awake for learning.
Yes.
That's what I say to my kids anyway.
The kids would literally have to be sort of freezing. And in the Castle Museum in York that I went to this week, they had sort of a rule book, and it was like, don't sit by the fire. You need to go out and do this and this and this and this to get warm. You can't sit by the fire. So it was very much don't.
Because you won't feel the benefit.
Yeah.
It seems like all her different ailments were just balancing each other out. Like, depression from the dead babies, delusions from the syphilis, like getting a nice even keel. Like,
yeah. So she did sort of recover a little bit, but I think she was in a bad way for a while. But I don't know how bad. I'm not sure of this evidence, but they hired a governess basically because they were like, well, she can't even teach them, so she's good for nothing. So she was more heavily involved in the like the birth and the care of her son later, who was called William. So she began to become, after he grew up a little bit, physically quite ill. Now, some sources say there was an obstruction to the bowel, which could be like twisted bowel or cancer. I guess they couldn't really look at it. I guess they just realised she wasn't going to the toilet anymore. And she died in May.
Well, every time she pushes, a baby pops out. Yeah. I stop as well.
So she died, unfortunately.
Oh.
And then...
So this is taking a twist. I thought she was going to get locked in the attic, Jane Eyre style, and then be murdered.
Do you know what? Jane Eyre is partly based on this story.
Is it?
A little bit. Well, some people say.
They did say that Mrs. Rochester might have had syphilis and stuff.
Yeah. So rumours began that the governess, Mary Drew Platt, who was living there, had an affair with the husband, Samuel. And then these were confirmed when he married her. So
very Jane Eyre.
So they'd literally been having an affair right under her nose. I'm sure she knew about it. So some of this apparent madness is
didn't
probably,
stop him knocking his wife up, though, did it?
Well, he's probably passing syphilis from one to the other.
It's amazing that we're just all descended from syphilis, aren't we?
Yeah. Now, Mary Drew Platt, so the governess, married Samuel Kent. So she becomes Mary Kent, similar to Mary Ann Kent, though, is his last wife. And they begin to have children together. So Mary was very much disciplinarian. She was really strict. She was very dismissive of the children from his previous marriage. So Mary Ann's children, who were Constance, William and Mary.
But she had been their governess.
Yeah. But she hadn't been very nice to them. Then she was very...
She must have been shit forever.
Yeah. So... there was no recognition of their emotions. She banned them from having pets or friends. And Constance was sent away to school quite a lot. And even when she returned after a long period, she talked about how it was as if she'd just come in from a walk, their reaction like, oh, you're back. Just completely not bothered. So Mary had three children with Samuel. So that was another Mary, Frances and Evelyn. And then she became pregnant with a fourth. And it was at this point that the murder happened. So,
I imagine one of the kids. I mean, there's plenty to go around.
So, 29th of June, 1860, 3-year-old Francis Saville Kent was kidnapped from his room And a dog barked, but basically that was the only bit of unrest that anyone was aware of. And no one really batted an eye at the dog barking. It was quieting down and everyone went back to sleep. So no one really woke up. None of the family or the servants noted anything. And then at 5 a.m, the 22-year-old nursemaid gets up and she discovers that Francis is missing from his cot. But she just assumed that his mother had come and got him in the night and that he was in their room and she didn't want to go and disturb them. So it isn't until about 7:30 when the family get up that she says Francis wasn't there, and then they sound the alarm. So a big search party starts by 8 o'clock. Everyone's out searching. All the servants have been told to go out searching. Neighbours are getting involved. And a reward of £10 is offered by the father if Francis is found.
That'll do.
Which is about 650 quid now.
I mean, I can't put a value on any of my children, but if I have to...
It's £650.
Yeah.
It's just such a weird... I guess they don't know he's dead yet. They're just sort of getting people to help.
Yeah.
So two men take a break from the search and they open the door to the servant's outdoor toilet or privy. And in there, they see a pool of blood on the floor. I don't know why they're going together. That's what I found. That's the weirdest thing about this story.
Well, they're trying to shirk their responsibilities. That's what the kids do when they want to get out of something. Like, oh, can we go to the toilet?
Can we go to the toilet?
No.
Never. So they pulled up the lid and inside they find a blood-soaked blanket and then underneath is the body of Francis. Ooh. And
because like it was basically like the hole wasn't just the hole, like the circle. You could lift it up and it'd be a box underneath, like a shit box.
Yeah, a box of shit. So
you could fit a child in it.
Yeah. So a cut was found across his neck. I mean, one of the men said that his head almost fell off when he pulled him up. And he was totally covered in blood. So national hysteria resulted based on this story. Think of it like Madeleine McCann was national papers, everyone talking about it. It was on that kind of scale.
I mean, that is horrific because it's somebody inside the house has targeted the youngest child, slit their throat. So it's not like a shaking or anything where like the cold-blooded murder of a child and just shoving that. Like, it is
and
very
also, like,
horrific.
Doors were locked, no one noticed anything. The dog barely reacted. It's a real murder mystery.
Especially when it's internal, like you suspect everyone. No one's safe.
Yeah. But it's just like a little family. So is it a servant? Is it a stranger? It's just such a mystery. It's sort of like Jonathan Creek-esque. Like, I mean, not... Yeah. So it's all brought out in the papers. You've got the madness of Samuel's first wife has talked about. And obviously that's really hyped up, so she made out to be sort of this loony woman. And then his adultery is featured in the newspapers. Everyone's talking about this.
Oh, so just the whole dirty laundry.
So then Samuel attempts to obstruct the police investigation, which is a bit strange, because you think he'd want everyone sort of looking out and looking for his son, or the, you know, finding out what happened. So in particular, there's an instance called the kitchen incident where some detectives were at the house overnight because they thought maybe someone would come back. They just wanted to be guarding the house as part of the inquiry. So they were led into the kitchen by Samuel themselves, and he had like beer and some food out for them. And they're like, oh, this is really nice. And it's not until they'd eaten and they'd drunk and then they got up to keep walking around and have a look that they realised they're locked in the kitchen and they can't actually get out. And then he leaves them in there till like 5:30 in the morning.
What?
Literally just leaves them overnight.
Surely that's a criminal offence.
False imprisonment. Yeah. It's really weird though.
Was he just like, whoops, I didn't realise I'd locked it.
I don't know. I think he just didn't want them sleeping around, or maybe he was like nervous because he's got kids in the house. But
yeah, I guess if at that time it was, if the police are investigating into your private business, it's going to become news. And it was just like, I'm just fed up of having it splashed everywhere. My kids are already dead. But to lock them in a room is false imprisonment. Like, you just kidnapped some police officers.
Yeah, so weird. So the family...
You're not coming out till you've done the washing up.
So the family appeared to act sort of normally before the murder. So Constance had gone on an errand that day and walked back with her brother William. And the two had met their stepbrother Francis, so the victim. They'd sort of played around, had been playing in the garden. And then Samuel, like they'd gone to bed. I think the kids went to bed about 10 o'clock, it said. And then Samuel had been the last to bed. And he'd sort of checked the locks as he did every night, and then he'd gone to bed about midnight. So the first inquiry was on the 2nd of July, and not one member of the family was asked to give evidence or even really questioned. So the crowd and the jury were pretty obvious with their displeasure, sort of. And I think it was more of a sort of circus than people would be shouting out in court, and it would be quite a big affair. So they relented and they questioned William and Constance, so their older siblings. This was rushed. The children gave short, useless answers. No one really thought through the questions, so didn't really give any detail. Then the investigation started to centre around the nursemaid, because the inspector believed that it was totally impossible for Frances to have been taken without her noticing. So he came up with this weird story that Frances had woken up and found the nurse in bed with a man and seen it. And so therefore her and this man, who there's not really any evidence of.
Because would she have shared the same room as the children or as the baby?
I think it's either the same room or next door.
Yeah.
It's seems likely. So they thought that he'd witnessed something and they'd sort of got rid of him so that he didn't see. And then he took it one further.
Because she would have lost her job and everything if she'd
yeah.
had that.
But then he took it one further and said that the man was probably Samuel Kent, the father.
See, that's also very likely.
So,
but
I mean,
then he wouldn't need to kill it if it was his dad, because it'd just be like, I can do whatever the fuck I want. It's my house.
Yeah.
Go to sleep.
Unless he didn't want his wife to find out.
Didn't bother him before.
But I mean, she...
She's got syphilis. She's going to die soon. That's the way to do it. Just give all of your wives syphilis, and then it's like a rotating...
But I mean, that makes a good story. I bet the press bloody love that, because he's already cheated on one wife with the nursemaid.
Yeah.
And then what's to stop him having another? But the more that this was really criticised by the press, basically, because there wasn't really any evidence of it. And you can't just go around making up stories and thinking, I reckon, even in the 1800s. So they weren't having any of it. And so they dropped that. They let her go. They'd even arrested her. And they changed to focus on Constance, because her nightdress that she'd been wearing that night had gone completely missing, whereas everyone else's clothes was available to look at. So they thought, well, that's a bit suspicious. So they arrested Constance. She's 16 at this point.
Oh.
So she's arrested and she's put in jail. And her father sort of pays for extra food and things to be given to her, and she's given a comfortable cell. And then she appears in court, and she, because obviously they need to decide if they're going to take it to trial. And in court, it's discussed how Constance was unhappy at home. They talked to some of her school friends from where she's at boarding school, but there wasn't really any motive other than that. She hadn't talked about hating Frances. She hadn't really talked about anything really extreme. So again, the press were like, what are you doing? You can't just go around sort of arresting people
just
with
clutching at straws.
Flimsy evidence. So she's released.
Because someone could have taken her nightdress, used it to mop up some blood. Like,
you can't arrest someone just on that. It's just...
No.
It's so insignificant. So 3 weeks after Constance's release, a man confesses at a train station. He's called Edmund John Gagg. And he says, I did the murder. So they go and arrest him. However, as soon as he sort of questioned... from this, he changes his story. He gives evidence that show that he was elsewhere, and that's dropped. So, I mean, these people are looking like idiots. Now, Constance continues to be featured in the press, and she's sort of made out to be a bit of a heroine, and people start making her offers of marriage. I think probably because she's a young girl in the press, it's a bit sort of like Kate Middleton's sister.
Yeah, and it's like not her fault.
There's a woman on
she's
TV.
She's just born into this family, and if she's good looking, that's when they love it, isn't it?
Yeah. So the family moves to try and escape this. So they sell the house, they move on. And then the wife, so Mary, she has two more children. She was actually pregnant when Frances was killed. So it's not long after that she has another child, and then she has one more after that. So she's got four, and then one's died.
Yeah.
So she's got a big family. Constance joins a home for religious ladies. She goes there. The inspector of the case retired, and it just remains as an unsolved crime for a number of years. But that could be the end of the story, but it's not.
Good.
So, because
otherwise I wouldn't want to hear it.
You know we hate an unsolved. So on April 25th in 1865, aged 21, Constance Kent goes to London's Bow Street Magistrate's Court, accompanied by a priest, and confesses to the murder of her three-year-old half-brother.
Oh, I was thinking maybe he was actually her son. Like, if her dad just fancied.
Yeah.
And then maybe she was like, this is gross.
That would be good, but it's not.
Oh.
So she
did do it. She just confessed.
She confesses. So she said she hated her stepmother and she wanted to kill her stepmother, but she's too big a target.
Can't fit her in the toilet.
Yeah, exactly. So, and she's like sleeping in a bed with her dad all the time. So she said that because that's too big a task, she decided that she would instead kill all of her children in order to hurt her. So she placed what she'd done, and I don't know if there's any evidence of this, and it is a bit questionable, but this is what she said. She wrote a letter and she took it with her. She'd gone down to the privy in the day, placed matches and a candle in there, so she'd been able to see what she was doing. She'd gone down and lit the candle. And then, after everyone had gone to bed, she'd crept into the nursery and taken Francis, and then climbed out of the window.
Yeah, because I guess he wouldn't have cried or anything, because he was like, oh yay, my sister.
Yeah. And gone to the privy where she cut his throat with one of her father's razor blades. And she said that she'd expected more blood, so she'd had another go, which is why it was sort of quite a severe death. Horrible. And then just dropped him down the privy. She said that her nightdress had had two spots of blood on. I thought there'd be way more considering that murder.
Yeah.
But that she'd gone to wash it in the bath and then she put it in a drawer and she'd taken a clean one to wear. But when the police had come, she'd been quite scared, so she'd moved the nightdress.
I mean, could have just said, I was wearing this one.
Yeah, I know. Who
shouldn't need it to
go
missing?
Double-checking that. Like, is it like there's certain like days of the week on them or something? Yeah. Like, who's checking? So then she burned that nightdress in the fireplace, so that's gone anyway. So at trial, she pleads guilty, even though the solicitor says, plead not guilty. And I think her father's very much on her side. I mean, I think he believes that she's done it.
Do you think she did? I mean, she was living in this home for religious ladies. And it was years later, was it?
Yeah.
She came forward.
I think
that's a long time for them to be like, confess things. You have to confess things every week at church.
Well, I think she confessed to the religious figures in the home and they were like, shall we go tell the police?
Yeah, but I just mean maybe she'd been living there so long that she just thought she'd done it.
Well, a lot of people didn't believe it because they said it was too stylized, it was too simplistic, that it was over exaggerated, that there was no real motive for her to confess. It had just been sort of put away. Like, no one was looking at that, no one was creeping around trying to find out anything. She was off on her own, so quite a lot of people said that they didn't believe her, but I don't know.
But then again, if she had done it living with the religious people for that long, they probably would have confessed. It's just a shock that if you hadn't murdered anyone or hurt anyone before, that the first time you would do it is such an intimate, gruesome way. You think you'd just try and poison him or something.
Yeah, I mean, 16 is an age where you do sort of get wrapped up in sort of the extremes and your hormones are raging.
Yeah, but there's arsenic lying around everywhere in those days. Just poison your mum.
Yeah, that's true.
Although maybe she was a bit of a psychopath, but we just don't know about it.
Yeah. So she pleads guilty. And in her motive, she states that she wanted to avenge her mother. So she said that Mary had basically taken her mother's place and that even when she'd still been alive, they'd been so horrid to her mother and she'd heard all the things that he said. They treated her with contempt. Mary had obviously despised Mary Ann, her mother. Samuel had obviously taken the side of his mistress. He'd basically treated Mary Ann with indifference in the last few years of her life. And then after her death, she said that Mary had slagged her off. She was horrible. And she really sort of began to hate this woman. So she also spoke out about feeling guilt and remorse and how she wishes she could take it back and how she didn't expect anyone to forgive her. But the press, like I said, didn't entirely turn on her. Most people believe that this wasn't the whole story. I don't know if maybe they thought there might have been some abuse or something else happening, or maybe that her brother had been an accomplice and she was trying to cover for it and save him. but most people sort of thought she was hiding something. The load of people went to her trial, I guess, because it was pretty exciting. And there's no EastEnders. So
yeah.
It's like the nearest version. Because I guess they didn't know if she was going to plead guilty or how sad she'd look and all those kinds of things. They all want to see it firsthand. Her father and her older sister attended as well. So she's sentenced to death by hanging. And at the last minute, they did say, do you want to change your plea?
Because they would have just been like, oh, great. If she'd have said not guilty, they'd have been like, yeah, we believe you anyway. It's
yeah,
fine.
Yeah. So they said if she changed her plea last minute, she wouldn't have been sentenced to death. Like, she might have got some time. But she refused to change her plea. And even her family, I mean, not a mother-in-law, she's not getting involved. But even her family was sort of begging her, saying, change your plea. But she's sentenced to death. But due to her only being 15 at the time of the murder, she's granted a reprieve by Queen Victoria. And so instead, she serves 20 years in prison. And she's released in 1885. She's aged 41. And although her time in prison was unpleasant, it wasn't as bad as before Elizabeth Fry's reforms. So she did sort of have the benefit of, I think we talked about, kind of, it used to be loads of women in one cell and really dirty, whereas it's a little bit more ordered by this time.
No one's going to force you to have children consistently for years of your life.
There you go. So in 1886, she moves. So just a year after her, she's released from prison, she goes to Australia using a false name. So the press don't even know about this. No one really writes about her. She's just sort of disappears. And she works there as a nurse. And then she dies, age 99. And she
she must have died like last year.
Yeah. And she worked as a nurse right up until her death. Although I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
Like, she's a 98-year-old nurse. But she obviously, I don't know, she obviously committed herself to helping others.
What year would that have been? I need to know.
So,
calculator.
Was she born?
If she was released in 1885,
God, this is
aged 41.
Yeah,
yeah. Then she lived for another. What, she died when she was 99. She lived for another 58 years.
Okay.
Why did it not press equals anything? I'm pressing equals. Nothing happened. 1940. Oh, that's not that exciting.
Oh.
1943.
So she missed the second one.
Less impressive. Sorry. I got really excited.
Yeah. So that is the death of Frances Kent. But we'll say, obviously, the story of Constance Kent.
Very interesting. While we're talking about pregnancies and stuff, do you think it's suspicious that Meghan Markle is pregnant already?
Why suspicious?
I just feel like how...
It's quick.
How convenient that whenever the royal family get married, they get pregnant immediately afterwards.
I think it's...
Like, normal people take a while to have a baby, either because they want to enjoy being married or because they're just trying for one. Whereas, like, Kate Middleton just popped it, like, got pregnant straight away.
I did think it was weird.
Pregnant straight away.
Yeah, I thought it was weird that it was so fast. But my mum went, she's 36, isn't she? But
yeah, like, I'm not saying make you any if faster, you want though. One, I just thought you would have...
I think they have all the tests and stuff, so they know exactly how likely
it is.
Make
them have IVF?
Yeah. I think they... conspiracy theory. But I think they selected the gender of the firstborn, Kate Middleton. I think she made it a boy.
Do you think?
I wouldn't be surprised.
I think she made it a boy.
I think she made it a boy. I don't know. You can do that, can't you?
By standing on her head after sex for 20 minutes or something.
Yeah. Putting a bottle of Coke up there.
But anyway, I guess if you're like part of the royal family, like, why would you not have one? Because you can have it and then give it to a nanny and not have to worry about going back to work or anything. So I guess it'd be easy.
Live your life. Okay. Also, I just wanted to mention that a lot of the information I got from A Greater Guilt, which is the story of Constance Emile Kent and the Road Murder, which is a good book if you wanted to check it out, by Nolene Kyle. Thanks, Nolene.
And if you want to hear more about the Meghan Markle pregnancy conspiracy, you can read my upcoming book, Why Is Everyone Getting Pregnant So Fast, due out in 2030. Okay, so I'm now going to tell you another story from British True Crime by me, Emma.
I thought this was the book. I was like, that's a very sort of broad name.
No, that's just...
I've just bought a bookcase and I've put all my True Crime books on it, but it's in the spare room. So if anyone comes around who doesn't know I've got a podcast, they're definitely going to think they're going to get murdered. Because they're like right by the bed. Well, what books have they got? Fucking hell. Like 40 murder books.
I just met someone, well, I like met up with someone at the weekend, and he was saying that a friend of his keeps telling people, like, whenever they mention True Crime podcasts, he's like, oh, I know the girl that does that. He thinks there's one True Crime podcast. He doesn't realise that there's actually 100. So I think I've been credited for Serial, everything. Anytime someone mentions that, I know the girl who does that. All the True Crime. It's me. So I'm going to tell you a story that begins on Monday, 19th of November in 1962, when a fire was spotted at 6:15 in the evening in a barn that was owned by a man called George Wood. So he lived and he worked at this Hill House farm. He'd just inherited it from his dad. So there was the farmhouse, then there was his bungalow that he lived in on the site.
Insurance scam.
And this barn was there. The dad had died before. It's totally fine.
He didn't want to be a farmer. He burnt him down himself.
No, well,
sold.
No, he liked it. He loved being a farmer, and he was a special constable in his spare time. Which,
oh, is that like a fake police officer?
Yeah, like policing's difficult. Let's just have maverick weirdos that want to chase people. They can be special. No, they were very. It's like community support. You're just helping out. It's great. Anyway, so this was near Bristol. And 4 hours after spotting this fire, 53-year-old George Wood was once again contacting the emergency services. This time, it was to report a missing person, his 57-year-old wife, Olive Wood.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So not long after, I thought you'd say something, because I know you love a funny name.
It is a bit funny, but like, then I was like, oh, like George Wood, Olive Wood, Olive...
I guess people use Olive in Knock Knock jokes to mean like, I love.
Yeah.
Like, Olive. Anyway.
There's no obvious joke.
There's no obvious joke.
I think
joke.
Peter Fell was still funnier.
I still don't understand why you find it funny. At the time, I was just like nodding and smiling, and I still don't know.
It sounds like pedophile.
Oh, yes. Okay. Kind of. Peter Fell. That was it. Peter Fell.
Peter Fell.
Oh, my God. So... let's recap. George.
There's been a fire.
Farmer sees a fire a lot later.
Lost his wife.
My wife's gone.
Like literally lost her or she's dead.
Well, he can't find her. So then, not long after he'd rung the police about his missing wife, the firemen that had been tackling the barn fire for about 5.5 hours found the charred corpse of Olive inside the barn.
Oh, God.
Yeah, you're not laughing now.
Is she flammable? Have we solved it?
She's not very flammable, no. She's just charred.
I found the source of the fire.
There's still a lot of her left.
People do spontaneously combust.
Sometimes.
I'm just getting annoyed.
No, only because I've already asked Lucy if she started watching Making a Murderer Part 2 and you haven't. But if you had, we'd be able to have a long discussion about exactly how long it takes for a body to burn and what it takes to keep a body burning. Ooh. So you should watch it.
Because... Is it the same person or is this a different case?
No, it's the same case. It's an update on it.
Okay.
You should start watching it.
God, I really... It sounds confusing.
It's hard to burn. We know it's hard to burn a body. We've discussed it's hard to burn a body before, but now there's a whole hour episode that really confirms my thoughts on how difficult it is to burn a body. So at this point, the fire still wasn't completely out, so police couldn't really examine the scene and determine whether or not this was a murder case. So that before they could really get in there, they'd have to sift out tons and tons of straw and hay, and not just tons colloquially, like actual... There must have been, it said there were between 10 and 20 tons of this straw and hay that they would have to move out before they could get in. The lock on the front of the barn door was so badly damaged by the fire that they couldn't tell if she'd been locked in there or not. But the body was immediately taken to be examined by Home Office pathologist Dr. Albert Hunt. So
they're all very basic names, aren't they? Wood, Hunt.
Yeah.
Like no one's... Like a secret immigrant or anything.
No, not here.
Very British.
They were a bit racist in the 60s. I've just been doing with... Well, that's a general statement. But I have just been... In 1963 was the Bristol bus boycott led by Paul Stevenson. And we just did role play on it in class.
Oh.
And all my kids were walking around going... You can't work here, you're black. And then they were like,
oh, God.
And then at the end of every drama performance, they were like, and now black people can drive the bus. Yay. It was really cute. But that was in Bristol at the time, and there was a lot of resistance to it. Basically, black people weren't allowed to drive buses. Now they can. So I'm not going to turn it into a full play. So Diana Wood was the 27-year-old daughter of Olive and George, and she spoke to reporters saying that her... I'll quote her. Oh, I need to get my West Country accent out, yeah. Don't I? Oi, oi. I'm just testing it. Looks as if mother must have been coshed or something and pushed inside after going to the barn. Perhaps she saw something suspicious.
Literally every American listener. Like, say again?
Coshed her some in and pushed inside the barn. Basically, so they thought it was maybe some random attacker that had hit her on the head and then just locked her in. She also, Diana Wood, said that how she would drive home from work every night and her mother would always be waiting to greet her at the farm gates with the dog. But the night of her death, the gates had been left open and there was no sign of her mother. On Thursday of that same week, the police took George Wood in for questioning, and the very next day, he stood before magistrates charged with the murder of his wife, Olive. Just a side note, it was his 54th birthday.
Not a big one.
So if anything, that tells me, though, that it definitely wasn't him, because everyone knows if you're going to do away with a partner by death or dumping... You wait until you get the presents.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, don't break up with someone before Christmas or Valentine's Day. Really, peak dumping time is May.
So, they thought it was him because they thought he'd killed her before the fire.
Yeah.
And then the fire was to cover the fact that she'd been murdered. Okay. Based on the daughter, her not being there when she was supposed to meet her daughter.
Yeah, just based on the fact that...
Like, she got missing earlier.
Well, and other things that we'll now go into.
Okay.
So the post-mortem had determined that the cause of death had actually been due to head injuries.
Okay.
And when they searched the farm, they found a blood-stained sack of soil in George's shed. And this made him think that basically he'd done it and set fire to cover it up. So not long after, January the 8th, 1963, was the committal hearing. And this was the first time that some of the details of this case were fully made public. So the prosecutor began by saying that this was a very curious case, as that even the prosecutor, wouldn't be able to give any evidence that would show George's motive for my God. Like, I've literally only been drinking lemon squash. Like, I've had like 5 pints of lemon squash and
maybe
I can't
speak. That's the problem.
Speak.
You need to have a beer.
Do you think it's the sugar? Do you think the sugar like speeds it? Like,
it's the lack of alcohol in your bloodstream.
Yeah, that could be it. Also, for Tom's, but it was his 30th birthday. I bought him like a load of this Club Mate, this like German energy drink.
So we have to ask for it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we have been drinking a lot of that. It's made from this tea, so it's supposed to be like a healthier.
Like kombucha.
I don't know what that is.
It's fermented tea.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah. So sorry if I'm slurring. Anyway, so the prosecutor said that he wasn't going to be able to supply any evidence that would show George's motive for murder. And in fact, he even admitted that all the evidence seemed to suggest that they were actually a devoted couple. So it wasn't a great start for them.
Yeah, it's not like he had an obvious affair or he was getting bored with her.
Nothing. There's no reason why he would have done it. The sequence of events was established as follows. So at 6 o'clock, Diana came home from work. At 6:15, a neighbour spots the fire and goes over to it. At 6:25, Diana then sees the fire and goes to the bungalow to ask her dad where her mum is. And so he cycles off to the barn, although he does have a cup of tea first and is like, ugh, he'll be fine.
Oh, shit.
Then 9:15, some hours later, George comes back from the fire and rings his brother-in-law to see if Olive's there. And the brother-in-law says no, and he comes to help with the fire and help find Olive. And he finds George at the time searching a pigsty, trying to find Olive, I guess.
To be fair, the fact that he had a cup of tea makes me less suspicious, because if he had murdered her, then he'd be ready to be like, oh no, and do sort of a fake,
yeah,
like, oh, it's awful, I hope she's okay.
As well, the barn that was on fire was being rented by somebody else. So I think he was a little bit like,
it's not really my problem.
Yeah, it's no big deal.
He's going to lose out on that rent money.
So then at 10:22, after they still can't find Olive, George then phones the police to report her missing. And finally, at 11:45, the firemen clearing the straw find the body of Olive. So the cause of death was recorded as being 2 to 3 blows with a blunt instrument that had fractured her skull. And the time of death was put anywhere between 3 p.m. when she was last seen at home and 6 p.m. at the start of the fire. So George told police he'd last seen his wife leave to meet Diana at the gates at 6:20.
And she never arrived?
Nope. There was some blood found on the gravel drive of the farm. But obviously at the time in the 60s, they couldn't test for DNA. They could only go off blood group. And all I could find about this blood was that they knew it wasn't George's blood group.
Okay.
So I don't know if they could identify which one it was exactly even. So when asked if he or his wife had been injured to cause these blood drops, George Wood became faint and had to be supported by officers, inexplicably. He then handed them some items with blood on, like in his pocket he had some paper with some of his blood on, a tin of matches. And he basically was saying, look, we work on a farm, like, there's regularly like little cuts to your hands,
yeah, that
and
makes sense.
Things. So you will find odd bits around that have got like the things in his pockets. I've cut my hands, I put them in my pockets. Like, there's little bits of blood around if you're looking for it. And of the objects he gave them, they were able to find some that were his wife's blood type and some that was his. When they searched the bungalow where the couple lived, detectives also found a wheelbarrow that had bloodstains on it that showed to be the same blood type as Olive. And that matched the blood type that they had found on the sack earlier. It was thought by the prosecution that George must have attacked his wife in the shed, put the sack over her head, and then moved the body to the barn in the wheelbarrow so that there wouldn't be any traces, like trails of blood left. Then made the fire to burn the evidence. Several witnesses came forward and they all testified to the fact that the couple were happily married. George never had lost his temper.
Yeah.
they just couldn't see it happening for any reason.
I mean, it makes me want to believe it's not him, but then also I guess there's some abusive relationships where literally no one has any idea about what's going on behind closed doors.
True.
It is possible to hide abuse.
Or if someone has some sort of brain injury and then your personality can totally change and you can become really erratic. But the pathologist then said it really wasn't possible for Ollie's head injuries to have been caused by any kind of fall or any kind of accident. It would have been a heavy, blunt weapon and it would have had to have been extreme force to cause the cracks in the skull the way that it did.
Yeah.
So sort of possible weapons that he put forward would have to be really heavy to be able to get the force of a human swinging them. So things like a tire iron, crowbars. And there was no soot found in her lungs. So she was definitely fully dead before she got into that barn.
Yeah.
And was put, so she was definitely put in there as a body to be burned. There were fibres found on the wheelbarrow handle that were consistent with those on Olive's cardigan, and yet more of her blood type was found on some of George's overalls hanging on the back door of the shed. It's really hard with blood type, I think, because it just is blood type. It could be so many people.
Yeah.
But obviously this is a small case. It's really out in the country. It's only going to be, there's no motives for anyone. So
I was
going to
say, what's the motive for anyone to do it?
Exactly. George Wood was committed to trial and he pled not guilty. So he was remanded at Horfield Prison while the trial was begun. It eventually began on the 4th of March in 1963 at Gloucester Assizes. The defence then explained that George Wood did not deny killing his wife, but that he would show he wasn't guilty of her murder as this had been a tragic accident.
What?
So the defence really played on the drama of this because now they had this sort of confession from George. They had lots of information. So in the courtroom, he was like, I am now going to produce the weapon.
Oh,
and obviously
God.
It was full drama because no one even knew what it was. And here they were saying that they had the object.
Why didn't he just say that all the time, though? So she died through an accident and then he'd moved the body.
That's what he's going to claim, yeah.
Right.
So the defence lawyer, I like that you just like, yeah.
Yeah, done.
Done. Yeah, that's pretty much that. So he brought a replica of this 6 foot long hoe. I assume, I thought you'd like that. I should have said 6 foot tall hoe.
Yeah.
I assume that's the universal term for the tool.
What a hoe. Yeah.
Like with a little flat, almost blade at the end.
Yeah.
Trotter thing, isn't it?
Chopping up soil in it.
Yeah, just doing a mini dig.
They're not that heavy though, are they?
A big steel end on it with a 6 foot long pole. Because I guess if we're going to talk gravitational potential energy, you've got the long pole and then if you can swing with some force. So here he goes. He's got this hoe. And it was shown to Dr. Hunt, the pathologist who'd examined the body, while he was on the stand. Blood had been found on the handle, and it was agreed that these nail heads on the top of the tool would correspond with these odd indentations in Mrs. Wood's skull. But Dr. Hunt would not agree with saying with any certainty that this hoe was definitely the weapon. He said, if I was going to say it, I'd have to have done some experiments. He actually said that I'd want to hit some animals in the head with it and see if it was consistent, which is pretty gross,
yeah,
but you have
to.
To check that the injury would be the same. So really, the defence messed it up because they wanted to have this drama of like, actually, we know everything. But if they'd have just said, here's the hoe, test it, they probably would have agreed it was the weapon, but the pathologist wouldn't say, having never seen it before, he's not going to admit right then and there, yeah, it's definitely the one.
Speaking of hoe, do you ever read Shakespeare with your primary kids? Do they not do that?
Sometimes. We've done Macbeth.
There's certain words that every time they all fall about laughing. Ho's one of them. Ho! And then, like, there's, like, certain ones that are all sort of, like, a bit, like, Rudy, what sound down?
I was
head.
What book? What was I doing with my kids? The Lady of Shalott. I was doing with my children, and at the start of it, it describes the scene of the river around the island, and then the willow that bends over, and the pussy. It doesn't say pussy willow. It says the pussied thing, basically. And all the kids are sensible. And then this one little wiener kid was turning around and giggling. And so I was just like, okay, you can talk to me afterwards about why you found that funny. And then after, he was like, I wasn't even laughing. I was just turning around and someone pulled her face. I was like, we both know.
Like, do you want to talk to me about pussy?
Like, come on, like... You know, I know you think that word's funny, like, but it's so not appropriate. He's 10 years old. But I think pussy is becoming a really common word. Loads of the kids are using, like, calling to, like saying, don't be a pussy or you're a pussy. They really don't, I don't think they know the derivative of it. It needs stamping out. Stop letting people get away with saying the word pussy, please.
I remember when we were at church and we used to go to that youth group after, and you guys all had to go home, but because my brother was there,
you got to stay late and
I had to stay with the older ones. And then they were telling jokes and they were all like, no rude ones. Like when anyone said a joke, they were going, it's not rude is it. Then I told my joke and no one said, it's not rude is it. So I told this joke that was basically about this guy in the bar, and then this ostrich and this cat come over with him, and the ostrich is going, I'm not paying. No, the cat's going, I'm not paying. And the punchline is, oh, I had three wishes, and I wish for a bird with long legs and a tight pussy. And I said the punchline and everyone went, and I was like, it's not that rude.
Lucy.
It is quite rude.
That's incredibly rude.
And I said it in front of all these church people. How mortifying. I die when I think of it now.
Oh God. Those are the worst as well, when you're with a group of older teenagers and you're trying to be like cool, and then you say something so cringy.
Oh, yeah, but there's the longest joke, the amount of build-up as well.
To get to a tight pussy at the end.
That's so gross.
That's brilliant.
Never. You've got to do these things.
You wouldn't even tell that joke now.
I know. You've got to have these embarrassing experiences, haven't you? Otherwise, you just stay like a teenager your whole life.
I think I could manage without them, to be honest. So, ho. That's how we got there. Ho, double entendre, pussy, cringe. Yeah. So, back to the ho. So, on the third day of George Wood's trial... the defence were finally actually starting to put forward their version of how Olive Wood's death came about. So, George was bringing the wheelbarrow with some firewood over to the bungalow. It was about 5:30 in January, so it would already be getting dark. In fact, quite very dark at this point. Probably it'd be dark by 4, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
A chicken had got loose and ran and went underneath an outbuilding and was hiding under there. So George called for his wife to come and help him get this chicken out. He went and got the hoe because it had this extremely long handle and he could sort of like nudge the chicken out, scoop it out. And they were able to catch it and they put it back in the hen house. By now, it was entirely pitch black and it was really difficult to see where they were going. So they headed back to the shed. George was in front, leading the way, and his wife was behind him. He was carrying the hoe over his shoulder. He had on really thick overalls, and his wife didn't. So when he came to this part of the path where brambles had fallen and covered the entire path, he said that he didn't want his wife's stockings to get ruined. So he started hacking at the brambles and swiping at them to move them out of the way. So when he swung the hoe and swiped at these brambles, he then swung it back over his shoulder and carried on walking. He said that as he swung it back to his shoulder, he felt something, but thought he'd just knocked it onto a nearby trailer that was next to them and carried on walking. He then said something to his wife, who didn't reply to him. So he turned around and saw her lying amongst the brambles.
Oh, what a horrid event. You'd never get over that, would you?
So he went over and he tried to pick her up.
Foul.
says he couldn't manage to pick her up because he had this knee injury. So he put the wheelbarrow on its side, rolled her into it, and took her back to the bungalow so he could try and administer first aid.
Was she still alive at this point?
He didn't know at this point. I mean, like, everyone had testified they were a devoted couple. He loved her. There was no issue. So to have done that to your, like, to the wife you properly loved, yeah, your horrific. Best friend, as pure accident is just...
But I don't know how you could... Like, I would be mortified, screaming, crying. I don't know how you could cover it up and just be chill.
I think he says that his reason for being so together is he got back... He saw that she was dead. He then saw the time and realised that his daughter Diana would be coming home from work immediately. And all he could think was, I don't want her to walk in and just see this horrendous scene. So he was just working on, like, I've just got to be able to get things away and then tell Diana what's happened calmly. Because he just, her father have just killed her mother. She's lying here. There's blood everywhere. I've got to just move this.
I don't think I'd react like that. I think she's like a grown-up Dory. It's not like she's some
baby. She's a grown-up Dory who lives at home. And a mum meets her every day at the gates. Yeah. But can you imagine just walking into the house and seeing them in the middle of that? You'd just immediately scream. It would be horrendous. I can understand him being like, I can't deal with her seeing it right now.
Oh, I don't know. I think I'd want someone to scream and cry with me.
So he just took the body to the barn and he put it in the hay. And he said that when initially he tipped the body out, but... Then he was like, oh, I can't leave her just dumped like this. I need to make her more comfortable. I need to, even though she was dead, people do things like that, don't they? They want it to seem nice. So obviously it's pitch black. So he says that he lit a match so that he could see what he was doing. The match head snapped off after being struck and fell into the hay, which immediately ignited the blaze.
I'm not on his side anymore.
See, that bit I don't believe. I think you did it by accident and then you thought, shit, I'll burn her and then I won't have to tell everyone that I did it by accident.
Yeah. Like, oh, whoops, I accidentally lit a massive fire. You
stranger things have happened, then that's only two coincidences. An accidental hitting, which could happen, and an accidental fire, which could happen. But...
Because I do always think, well, if it wasn't such a weird coincidence, then well, we wouldn't be talking about it.
But then we've heard of stories before where someone has not been given a sentence for they've not been found guilty of the murder charge. They've been found guilty of accidental killing in worse circumstances than this.
Yeah.
Like the guy that I did the other week who fucking killed that guy by accident, buried him under the floorboards for 20 years. And he didn't even get charged with proper murder, even though he hid the body under floorboards.
Yeah, that's true.
Just because he hadn't destroyed it. So I would... Anyway... So, George Wood cried while he was giving his testimony of the events, and he just reiterated over and over how his only thought was keeping the horror of the circumstances from his daughter. His daughter, at hearing this was the first time she'd heard this story, just broke down and had to be escorted from the court by her uncle. The following day of the trial, the doctor, who was called by the defence, described how he'd been experimenting with swinging a hoe at a dummy the size of Mrs. Wood to determine if a single blow could cause such injury to a skull.
Imagine his wife walking in like, what are you doing, love?
You really need to watch Making a Murderer Part 2, because they get a dummy and they like pour blood in its hair and they practice swinging the dummy around to see what the blood spatter would be. Things haven't changed a lot since then. So he'd been doing a lot of practice and... He said that it can be done. If he really is just swinging it carelessly, it could cause that sort of injury. It was noted by the judge when he was speaking that he said, surely, if you've hit someone with that much force, you would have turned around straight away to see what's happened. And then the defense sort of had this weird little argument where they said that it's exactly that. That's what you'd say if you were making up a story. If it hadn't been an accident, you'd say, I hit something and I turned around to see what it was and there she was lying down.
Yeah, that's true.
So the fact that George said, I felt a little something but didn't think what it was and walked off and then turned around is such an odd little addition to the story.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because I was a bit like, well, we're just going on what he said anyway. So it's all sort of irrelevant. because we can't prove it either way, but it does make him seem more innocent in that he has all these little details.
Yeah, it wouldn't help his cause to say that he walked off. It would seem more likely, so it could be the truth. The prosecution went to great lengths to show that it was the behaviour of George Wood after the death that truly showed his guilt, pretty much what you were saying, that an innocent man would have called the police straight away and would have been cooperative. Mm. And if it really was how you said, you would not have got rid of the body.
Yeah.
So then again, the judge, when he was speaking to the jury before their deliberation, said that Wood's claim that he was acting out of concern for his daughter, but he actually then, when asked about what were you going to tell her, if you'd have just put the body in the barn and then you were going to see your daughter, what would you have done next if the fire hadn't happened? And George Wood just said, well, I guess I would have called a doctor or something. And he was like, that's the bit that doesn't seem right. If he was trying, what was his actual plan then? The jury took 45 minutes to consider the verdict.
That's not long considering, I can't even decide.
No. Apparently when they came back in, they thought that they were coming back to ask a question because they couldn't believe it had been that quick. And they returned a verdict of guilty.
Whoa.
So George Wood said to the judge, he said, have you got anything to say? And he just basically said, only that I have told the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And then he was sentenced to life imprisonment for his wife's murder.
That's a weird one, isn't it?
Super weird. I think after doing that case about the guy who killed his friend and buried him under the floorboards, if he could get away with accidental death, then this guy should have.
Yeah, but it's different judges. You can't use one of
the barometer.
Because
the other guy had a motive for doing it, that they had this weird scam and he'd signed the insurance fraud and stuff.
That's true.
And this was just... But I do think he tried to burn the body and thought, I'll make it look like an accident.
Yeah. Yeah, it is weirdly, and it's weird. His reaction's weird.
But reactions are weird, but I don't like using how people react to trauma as a barometer for guilt or not, because people act in so many different ways. Like, you might not cry, you might feel numb, you might be hysterical, you might be angry, you might be withdrawn. And I think to judge, ooh, fireworks, that means the drugs have arrived.
Oh, does it?
Yep. I've told you this before.
Yeah.
Means the drugs have arrived. Unlike that fucking banging sound earlier, which sounded like Tom was repeatedly falling over in the bath. I guess he was just turning over or something.
Dad up there in an accident. We're both going to go to fucking trial.
I'm going to say, if we are, you're the key witness, so you get your story straight. Anyway.
So, thanks for listening. thanks for listening. And if you would like to support the podcast, you can join the Facebook, you can tweet us at Slaughter the Pod, you can follow us on Instagram.
You can email us at slaughterthepodcast@gmail.com.
You can donate to our Patreon. And every time I sort of think, ugh, I'm tired, is this worth it? I always think of the little Patreons who are so kind in generously giving us their money. That's what keeps me going. I think if people are willing to pay for this podcast, then we've got to give them some love. And you can just tell your friends about the podcast. And remember, listening to Slaughter doesn't make you a psychopath.
To be honest, I'm not sure what does anymore, because I don't want to judge people like that.
I do want to be on a jury, though.
No one's going to let you with that fake tan. Suspicious.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free.
or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.